You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
I first learned about Pierre Hadot in a John Milbank book, and ever since I've read everything of his that I could get my hands on. Hadot's revolutionary power resides not in a particular claim or argument, but in a method. He investigates Plato and the Stoics and eventually even Wittgenstein as shapers of lives, teachers who lead disciples into new ways of life through philosophical disciplines. Although Hadot is not one of the heroes of the Kantian religion, and we might get back to Hadot at some point, Dr. Ian Hunter's recent book, The Kantian Religion, brings Kant into that same revolutionary matrix, investigating the ways that Kant, in his own day, for many, the picture of the detached modern philosopher, was making disciples with his philosophy. Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome Dr. Hunter to the show to talk about this fascinating book. Ian, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Nathan. It's a real pleasure to be here and to talk to an audience that I've never had access to before, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Very good. The Kantian Religion is an ambitious book, and I'm going to spend our entire interview resisting jokes about Copernican revolutions. But to start with some methodology, your approach to Kant is, as the book title promises, and as I talked about in the opening statement, more like historical critical religious studies than it is a philosophical history in the way that someone like Hegel might understand philosophical history. You are interested in social context, rival sects, practices of spiritual development, to use a phrase from my own seminary days. So in broad strokes and briefly, we've got a lot that I want to get to in an hour. How does your approach diverge from the ways that people have studied and taught Immanuel Kant in recent decades?
Great start, Nathan. Thanks a lot. As you say, we've got a lot to get through, but I think it's going to be fun to move widely and quickly across a whole territory and light on things that interest us. But as you say, we need to begin with a basic an account of the basic shift that I'm putting forward in the book. And you could look at it in this way, rather than treating Kant's arguments as the product of transcendental reflection and the recovery of things from the mind, I look at them as devices for attending to the self and acting on the self with a view to transforming it. Turns out to transform it into the notion of a higher kind of self. So if that's the beginning point of the book, that immediately pushes us into a new territory because it opens up another set of questions. The questions that I then want to look at are, well, where did he get these devices from? How did he improvise a certain, let's say, a certain domain of spiritual practice that hadn't previously existed? And then what purposes was he going after in developing this new way of attending to and acting on the self? And I guess finally, we'll get to eventually, how did the existing confessional religions react to this interloper coming into their territory? And what did that mean for the reception of Kantianism among the biblical ecclesiastical religions and Judaism?
Mm-hmm. Now, your chapters on Kant's books start with Critique of Pure Reason, and that's the Kant book that I've spent the most time with. And I realized as I took on your project that I am shaped by the conventional Kant reading practices that you are challenging, that you are resisting. And I realized it most fully, I think, right about page 50 of your book, when you write that, quote, noumena can only be objects of concern for Kantian philosophers, end quote. For our readers who haven't spent as much time with Kant, what does the term noumena mean, first of all? And how does your approach to noumena and phenomena and that distinction between the two differ from the ways that people normally teach Immanuel Kant?
Yeah, a great question, not an easy one to answer, but we'll get there. But we need to get to it, we need to give a really brief account of what I would call the basic picture of cognition that Kant works with, because that's only within the context of that we can understand what the noumena are. If we were to just to give a quick pen sketch of how does Kant think knowledge works, then we begin with his model of that man is a creature with two faculties or two natures. That's a really crucial thing, and I'd like to get back to that in part when I go to answer the kind of question I've already adverted to, namely, where does he get these devices from? But we'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. But he has this device that man has got two faculties, sensibility and reason, or sensibility and understanding. Cognition works for Kant because the sensibility throws up what he calls a scatter or a rhapsody of sensible impressions. These are yet unintelligible. They're rendered intelligible by the a priori operations of the understanding, which synthesizes them into objects of cognition. Now, because that's how cognition works on Kant's model, we can never know things in themselves. We can only know appearances or phenomena, that is, the synthetic products of our own understanding acting on sensible impressions. Now, that's the basic picture. Now, you could say noumena are the opposite of the phenomena. Phenomena are appearances. Noumena, could we know them, would be things in themselves, as he calls them, die Dinge an sich, or die Dinge an sich selbst. And that is the idea of things that would be known not through our understanding, but as they are in themselves. So that's the first meaning of noumena. But if you think about it, it immediately brings up a second, probably more important meaning or connotation of noumena, which is that if these things, noumena, could be known, then they would be known by an intelligence that thought them and brought them into existence by thinking them. That's because it wouldn't be our intelligence, as Kant said. It would be, well, he says, God's intelligence can bring the noumena into existence. But if there's an intelligence that knows things by thinking them, okay, that's the crucial idea. It's not ours, Kant says. That intelligence is also the noumenon. So the noumenon is a pure intelligence that brings things into existence by thinking them. And the prime example is God. Now, if this goes deeply into Kant's bigger picture, because if God is the noumenon, then it follows directly that we can't know God in theoretical terms. He lies beyond human knowledge. But there's a secondary and equally important consequence or connotation of this conception of the noumenon, which is that human intelligences might themselves be noumena. But they would then be thought of as intelligences existing outside space and time. Now, in the groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, Kant calls this universe of intelligences the kingdom of ends in themselves. And that proves to be an important aspect of Kantian philosophy. So there are two kinds of noumena. There's God, and then there's human intelligence thought of as existing outside space and time. And then, if you like, there's also the notion that the noumena is the thing in itself, understood as outside human knowledge. That's probably an incredibly complex picture to have painted, and I probably could have done a better job, but that's what noumena are in Kant, yeah.
Now, let me ask you this as a follow-up. Your approach to noumenon and phenomenon is that they are the products of certain ascetic disciplines. So these are philosophical training that actually gets someone to the point where they can actually think in these terms. So
yes,
again, you know, the difference here, and, you know, as I described that, it is very different from the way that I learned how to read Kant. You know, when I learned Kant, I'll put it that way, noumena and phenomena were descriptive terms. They applied to the way that rational beings processed what is real. Yeah. So your approach, again, treats this as, you know, something like a Stoic discipline or a Jesuit spiritual practice. And what's great about this book, first of all, listeners, this is a 500-page book, so we're barely going to skim the surface in an hour. But you don't just assert that Kant is, you know, doing this as a spiritual exercise. You do the historical work and you show some documentary evidence. And one of those historical figures you quote to show this side of Kant's influence is someone named Jakob Beck, or Jacob Beck. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. When Beck writes in response to Kant, if he doesn't articulate contrary arguments, what does his alternative to Kant look like?
Yeah. No, Beck's a good example to bring in at this point for two reasons. The first one is that, to go to your main point here, if we're to think about the phenomena and the noumena as the product of a particular kind of spiritual exercise or way of relating to and acting on the self, one of the best ways is to contrast it with what came next, absolute idealism. Now, the thing about the absolute idealists is that they said, well, yes, Kant is a great guy. He made some huge strides, but he got something wrong. And what he got wrong is that he posited that we had these two faculties, sensibility and understanding. We don't need two faculties. We've got this other thing altogether, which is absolute intuition. Absolute intuition brings its objects into existence by thinking them. Well, we've come across this already. Kant had fully understood this, but he said only God had that capacity, right? But the absolute idealist said, no, we all do. Now, here comes Beck. Now, the interesting thing about Beck is there are a few things. Firstly, he was a former student of Kant's. Secondly, Kant had employed him, or he'd come into an arrangement with Kant to produce an account of Kantian philosophy that was more teachable.
Right.
Not that was exactly popular, but was more teachable. And he was going to write, he in fact produced three volumes of extracts and explanations and commentary designed to make Kant more teachable. Now, in the course of doing this, he wrote this letter to Kant that I focus on in the book, where he said, look, Emmanuel, I've been working through this stuff. I've gotten the middle of my second volume, and I have to say to you that there's a real problem with what you're doing. It's too difficult for students.
Yes.
And he calls, Kant calls students in a quite interesting phrase. He calls them moralische Lehrlinge, moral apprentices. Now, these moral apprentices are, they're undergraduate students being taught in theology and philosophy faculties. And Beck feels his mission is to make Kant intelligible to them. But he says to Kant, there's something about your basic model that's just too difficult. And what's right. too difficult is that you require the students to firstly be skeptical about empirical experience, to treat it as just a rhapsody of impressions, then to go into themselves, to recover in themselves the transcendental conditions of knowledge, the categories, space and time, as forms of intuition, and then to say they can understand what cognition is. And Beck has the temerity to say to Kant, that's just too hard. They can't do it. And when they can't do it, they blame you. Now, they blame your philosophy. They don't blame themselves as being dumbcoffs, but that's something we've got to deal with. So he says, the way I propose to deal with it is to get rid of the two-faculty model. We don't need it. What we can have is a single faculty, which is we say to the students, begin inside the categories and think of yourself as producing objects of knowledge by thinking the categories. Now, you can understand why later on the absolute idealists, took Beck as a sort of precursor, because right. that's very like what they were doing. But for us, our immediate interest is that Beck didn't try to say to Kant, you've got it wrong. He said, it's too hard. Now, what was it that was too hard? Well, it was the exercise. So you could say what I'm doing with Beck is bringing him in as further evidence for the exercise-based character of this style of philosophy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes good sense. And the funny thing was, as I worked my way through this book, 20 years of reading Kant the old way were resisting you at every step. But then you would bring in these historical responses to Kant from his own moment, there in the 1780s, 1790s, early 19th century. And time and again, people were responding to Kant as if you were right and I was wrong. So I said, okay, I need to take this seriously, because my own experience tells me that, this is the wrong way to take Kant, but Kant's own contemporaries seem to take him as doing something like therapy. And in fact, you use that word in the book. What does Kant's project there in the late 18th century share in common with psychological therapies that our listeners might find familiar, and what distinguishes what Kant is doing from more recent notions of therapy?
Yeah, again, a great question. I don't consider myself at all expert in modern forms of therapy, but I can.
Oh, me neither.
Produce
me neither.
A bit of. Well, that's good. We can produce a bit of a sketch, though. I mean, we could say something like this: that you could say that broadly, therapy involves a way of attending to and acting on the self in order to overcome its weaknesses, to alleviate mm-hmm. distress of various kinds, to deal with problems of life of various kinds. And we know, and you allude to this in your question, that Epicurean and Stoic philosophies have long been analyzed and studied as therapies of that kind. And it, mm-hmm. it makes good sense to do that.
Right.
I mean,
Pierre Hadot's project, and I might try to get you to comment on Hadot here in a moment, but his project is to say it's not just the Stoics and Epicureans doing that, but Plato's doing that, Aristotle's doing that.
Exactly.
A lot of philosophers are doing that well up into the late medieval period.
Exactly. That extension from, let's say, Epicurean and Stoic self-management into forms of insight into the transcendental as an exercise is what Hadot is about. And not just Pierre, but his partner, Ilse Trout Hadot, who worked on Plato in exactly these terms and wrote a couple of brilliant books on Plato in these terms. So what you've said really covers the core of my answer, which is that if you extend this to, let's call them theoretical or epistemological philosophies, you've got a lot of what Pierre Hadot is doing and also other people who are working in this vein. To come to the second part of the question about how this relates to modern therapies and modern forms of therapeutic analysis, well, I would say something like this, that, and here my answer would be inflected a little through Michel Foucault's work on the history of sexuality, that post-Freudian therapies differ from, let's call them these earlier philosophical therapies in various regards. I mean, specifically, firstly, the introduction of unresolved sexual problems as a cause of psychological distress is a key to modern post-Freudian models of the therapeutic work. And the second is something like the role of a confessional relation between the analyst and the analysand, which we don't find in the same way in Epicurean and Stoic philosophies. There too,
that makes good sense.
You had a sort of relation to a master, but the master was more something to be emulated, a model to transform yourself into. If the master showed how you, for example, could govern anger by doing certain exercises to calm yourself, you imitated the master and you learned to master yourself in that way. But it wasn't that the master saw into your soul and became the analyst that you had to confess your weakness or your underlying sexual problems to. It wasn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Foucault, as you probably know, makes the early modern development of confessional technologies in the church, in the Catholic Church in particular, to be crucial to the emergence of modern psychotherapy. And something like that is the way I would go with that question. But as I say, it's not something I've worked on in any detail.
Very good. We are going to get past Critique of Pure Reason, but since it's the book that I've spent the most time with, this is how I kind of understand your project, is by starting where I'm most familiar. So I got one more question about Critique of Pure Reason, and it has to do with the cosmological antinomies. So whenever I've read them, and, you know, as listeners know, I've read three different translations of Critique of Pure Reason. I haven't read it in German because I haven't studied German, but I take his antinomies as descriptions of the limits of reason and the errors into which reason tends to fall simply by operating as reason. And like I said, for 20 years, I've taken that as a description of how rational beings simply operate. You treat these antinomies more like a contradictory poem from the Tao Te Ching, maybe a Zen koan. What kind of mind is Kant trying to develop for his disciples through thinking of things in these ways that contradict each other, and yet each side of the contradiction is also true?
Yeah. Again, a great question. And I think your reference to Zen practices and Eastern religious practices, absolutely spot on. At the time, not many people did think that Kant was on that track, but one person who did was Arthur Schopenhauer. He said that Kant had a lot in common with the Eastern religions, and that we should think about, when Kant talks about the world as an appearance, we should think about the Zen and Buddhist models of the world as an illusion. He said that this is the key to understanding Kant. That's a little bit of a sidetrack. But yeah, the antinomies, you would not be in the, you wouldn't be alone in thinking that our prior understanding of them was that reason itself catapulted us into these contradictions. There wasn't anything, there wasn't anything historical about them. And what catapulted us into the illusion was the thought that we could go beyond all of the conditions of knowledge and find the unconditioned condition of knowledge. And that is where reason oversteps its mark, and it falls into illusion by imagining that there is such a thing. And when it does, it produces these contradictions. That's Kant's explanation of how this works. But what I do is I go to the antinomies themselves. There are four of them, as you know, and the cosmological antinomies. And I suggest, well, what if we look at them in a different way, as having historical origins? And what if we look at Kant's exercise as a way of overcoming what are really cultural, political problems? That's my basic shift. Now, to take one, because you can't do all of them. But if you take the second antinomy, this is the antinomy that says, on the one hand, there are indivisible simples or substances in the universe. And then on the other hand, the contradiction is there are no such simple substances. The world is infinitely divisible in the manner of a geometric division. And we never arrive at a simple substance. Now, and Kant's antinomy is to show you, in the end, on his view, on his model, how both are false. But forgetting that, if you look at, well, what is he actually doing here? Where did he get those antinomies from? You don't have to look too far, because the first side of the antinomy, that there are simple substances, is really Leibniz's doctrine of monadology. The monadology teaches that there are monads. Monads are simple substances. They are meant to be the constituent elements of the universe. We don't go to the deep, no need to go into the detail. And then the mathematical physicists of the period came along, and I'm thinking in particular of a Swiss mathematical physicist called Leonhard Euler, who took issue with this and said, look, I'm a geometrician, I'm a mathematical physicist, and I can show you that, in fact, the universe is infinitely divisible through functions of algebraic functional division, repetitive division, recursive division. We never arrive at a single simple substance. Now, Kant, on the one hand, had rejected the monadology because it required knowledge of things in themselves, monads. On the other hand, he saw that if people like Euler had their way, there would be no substances in the universe left. There would only be empirical space and time and empirical objects. The whole spiritual dimension of the universe would be lost. So what am I going to do to deal with this problem? Well, I'll construct an antinomy. The antinomy allows us to see, according to Kant, that both sides are false, because they both want to treat things in themselves, the monads on the one hand and space and time on the other. Therefore, this solves the problem, and it saves metaphysics from mathematical physics, but by giving people a new disposition, intellectual disposition, and that is the disposition that says both are false. That's not an easy answer, I realize, but that's what's happening. And that is the exercise of the antinomy, the second antinomy. Yeah. That's the best I can
do. Right. And like I said, you know, I really have come to the view that this is a revolutionary take on Kant. It really does go in a different direction from everything else that I've read about him. But the revolutionary character of this is that it is a spiritual discipline that gets you to that point. This is not simply a description of how every rational being already operates. This is an aspiration, not a mere description. Yes. And that extends to Kant's ethical thinking. Thank you. I promised our listeners we'd get past Critique of Pure Reason, so we're going to go on to the Critique of Practical Reason now. David Hume famously denies that reason has the capacity to lead to action. But Kant, as I've read him before, describes ways in which reason does that work for rational beings. But once again, your reading offers a different reading. So how do we encounter, or how does a Kantian philosopher, I'll put it that way, encounter archetypal reason, and how does that encounter lead those Kantian philosopher disciples towards the possibility of good action?
Yeah, again, a great question. Look, here's an interesting thing to say. The notion that Kant is interested in archetypes, archetypal reason, archetype and ectype, is not a commonly accepted reading of Kant in 20th century American literature, right? But interestingly, at the beginning of this century, the 21st century, a group of Christian Kant scholars have taken archetype and archetypal reason to be central to Kant. And that's not uninteresting. These guys, Nathan Jacobs, I'm not going to be able to bring them all to mind, but there's a group. My memory is failing me, but they have come along and said, actually, you do have to have a Platonistic understanding of Kant to really get it to grips with what he's doing. Now, in terms of the question you ask, this is an important shift. I'm not a follower of their school, but I think they're absolutely right about this. And here's what I would say about your question. Yes, Kant says practical philosophy is about how to act as opposed to how to understand and think. That's true. Mm-hmm. But then when you look at the second critique, at the Critique of Practical Reason, it turns out that his focus on the archetype is not really about action. How to put this? I mean, it's commonly said, and it's not incorrect, that Kant's moral philosophy is less about action than about the quality of the will.
Right.
Right. And Kant himself says numerous times, it's one of his slogans, the only good thing is a good will. Mm-hmm. And now the good will is one that's formed through thinking the archetype of the moral law. And you can do that without acting at all. Mm-hmm. Or if you like, putting it another way, that is the action, is to think the archetype and to determine your will, give your will purity by thinking the archetype. Now here, as we know from the 20th century debates, the great alternative comes from Catholic virtue ethics. Now, Catholic virtue ethics is indeed about action. It's not about the purity of the will. So it's about goodness is determined by the ends or the values through which we conform ourselves in order to realize those ends. They are that conforming oneself to do this is called virtue. Virtue is action in order to realize a good end. Now, that's the alternative to Kant. Kant, you could be the best of people merely by willing in a certain way without doing anything. So that is probably part of the answer to your question about how does Kant view good action. In a way, he doesn't. concern himself right. much with good action. He concerns himself with good willing. And mm-hmm. if you have good willing, on his view, then you would act well. But to have a good will, you have to suspend interest in external ends and goods. Now, that was part of the reason why Thomist Catholic philosophers in his time and in our time, I'm thinking of people like Alastair MacIntyre, Charles Taylor, Michael mm-hmm. Sandel, all reject Kant's moral philosophy because they are virtue ethicists. Yeah? So the idea mm-hmm. that you could be good merely by having a good will, no, that's not acceptable in the Catholic tradition. So that's what I think your question leads me to comment on. It's that difference mm-hmm. between the way in which morality is conceived and practiced in two different traditions.
All right. Listeners, as you can tell, this is a book that raises so many good questions that we're going to have to do what is painful right now and jump over some chapters. But I do want to get to the discussion of evil that arises in religion within the boundaries of mere reason. So in your chapter on that book, you show that Kant leads philosophical disciples through these same kinds of practices of reflection, contemplation, spiritual training, by contemplating evil deeds, again, as two natures. One of their natures is they are free choices, the actions of rational agents, and in their other nature, they are propensities. They are the results of discernible circumstances. So once again, in the past, when I have read these passages, I take Kant as doing a descriptive task. He is describing the difficulty of thinking about evil and about evil actions. How do these work as ascetic disciplines? What would the spiritual training look like to think about evil actions in these ways?
Yeah. I love these questions, but they're amongst the most difficult I've ever had to answer. But this one is a great one. It's great and it's difficult. So here's what I would say, something like this. Kant deals with the question of evil by setting up a contradiction, as you indicate. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do from there is to say, once he's done that, he then transmutes it into an antinomy. As soon as mm-hmm. Kant establishes an antinomy, he's given himself the exercise through which he's going to resolve the contradiction. That's the broad picture for dealing with mm-hmm. this problem. But what he comes up with is, for us moderns, let's put it like that, a really very unusual, potentially esoteric model of thought and action. And it goes something like this, that the contradiction he sets up looks like this. It's central to Kant's moral philosophy that we are all completely responsible for our actions. That's what moral autonomy means. All our actions that we undertake must be imputable to us as right or wrong, as evil or good. And if that's not the case, if you try and palm them off into the devil or some external force, then you are not being moral. So that's the first wing of the contradiction. But the second wing, which a lot of his followers did not like and wished he hadn't introduced, but the second side of the contradiction is that, on the other hand, it turns out we've got an evil nature, right? We are predisposed towards not acting well, not acting on the basis of the thought of the moral law, but rather fulfilling our sensuous desires, or what he calls our sensuous inclinations. And that's part of our nature. So here's the contradiction. On the one hand, we're freely acting agents who are responsible for all our actions. On the other hand, we're not freely acting agents. We are determined by an evil nature. So how on earth can we resolve this antinomy? Okay? Mm-hmm. I could stop here and say, well, who knows? But no, I won't.
And incidentally, that's what Boethius does at the end of Consolation of Philosophy. It says, this is a contradiction, sit with it and go pray.
That's a good answer. That's a great answer. And in a way, you know, in a sense, Kant comes out at something similar. But before he gets to that point, which he does get to, he says this odd, he makes this unusual for us doctrine, namely this paradox or this contradiction or antinomy can be overcome if we think of ourselves as beings existing outside space and time who choose mm-hmm. their own moral nature. Now, right. we choose a moral nature freely. That means we can no longer freely choose, right? We choose a nature mm-hmm. that predisposes us to act on our sensuous desires. Then Kant says, more or less, but why?
Yes.
Why do we do this? And then he goes to Boethius, like he doesn't cite Boethius, but then he says, we don't know, it's a mystery. mm-hmm. it's a mystery beyond our understanding, but that's just the way it is.
Right.
So that's not uninteresting.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to make another jump.
Yeah, because... the takeaway...
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
So, no, the takeaway is to say something like, we are creatures that invent our own nature. Now, the only creature mm-hmm. that invents its own nature really is some kind of platonic notion of a being that exists prior to embodiment. Yeah?
Right.
And it chooses its own embodiment. And that's why he says we fall into our acts of immorality. We fall from a state mm-hmm. of innocence, says Kant, into our actual empirical acts, which are never innocent.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's so much here. Listeners, yeah, once again, I'm going to apologize as we make another jump, but there are other parts of the book I do want to talk about. And one of them is Kant's use of the Christian religion. This is part that I really wasn't familiar with in my own Kant reading. But when he starts to propose a shape of a spiritual community in which people could learn to be Kantian philosophers, I mean, that itself could take up an hour, but I'm going to ask you to be brief nonetheless. So when Kant does propose a spiritual community, it still involves the Christian New Testament. But in ways that are very, very different from, I mean, by Kant's time, a 300-year humanist tradition of biblical scholarship would teach people to, you know, use to approach the Bible. What is Kant's approach to the New Testament, and what does he have to say about those Christian humanists, since we're on the Christian Humanist Profiles podcast?
Great. Yeah. Absolutely. And I am going to follow your advice and I'm going to cut to the chase. So I would say something like this, that what Kant does is something very unusual, although he would be followed in this by Schelling and Hegel. He says that there is something called a pure moral religion or a pure religion of reason that has existed from eternity, outside space and time, and that is the core of religion. Christianity was the point at which it entered time. And it entered time not in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament. So for Kant, and it's just an extraordinary theme in his religion book, that writing as such, Schrift, and then Schrift in the sense of the scriptures, and then simply in the sense of the New Testament scriptures, are the only thing in the empirical world that contains the timeless moral religion within them. The only thing. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a model for this because that's the way the church used to be described. The church used to be described as the meeting of eternity and temporality, as the only thing on earth, as God's mystical body, Christ's mystical body on earth. But Kant says it's the scriptures. This is the preface to him saying that the true church is an act of hermeneutic reading of scripture. We read scripture to get rid of all of the historical dimensions and retrieve this pure moral religion. And that's what his view of scripture is. Now, as you rightly point out, by this time, this is a Johnny-come-lately moment, because ever since the 16th century, Christian humanists had been involved in intensive study of the Bible as an archive of revelations. And that 300 or 400 year tradition was maintained in full force in Kant's time at the University of Göttingen. Excuse me. And at Göttingen, you had these extraordinary scholars who were working on the Bible as an historical deliverance of the divine message, but one that existed in time and existed in texts that had to be deciphered. So they could not, you could not read the Bible without philology, without contextual historiography, without working out what did the biblical peoples do with that book. Now these guys, J.D. Michaelis, his student Eichhorn, the great ecclesiastical historian Mosheim, they were all at Göttingen, and they were writing extraordinary works. Your answer to your question is, what did Kant do with them? He ignored them. Not just ignored them, but he said, actually, what these people do, and he mentioned Michaelis and Eichhorn by name, is that they produce what he called a scholarly religion. And a scholarly religion is not a true religion. It's a religion that requires scholarship. Okay. But the true religion, the true moral religion, the true timeless religion that was merely being brought forth in the vehicle of the New Testament does not require scholarship. It requires intuition or Kantian philosophy in order to decipher it. It requires hermeneutics. And hermeneutics is what regenerates you. Now, we don't have time to go into this, but in the book, I go into a bit of detail. When Michaelis, Eichhorn, and their colleagues heard this, they blew up. Yeah. They said, well, who is this Kant guy, right? Who is he to say that there is this hidden moral religion inside the New Testament? What would he know? He's never done an historical work. Now, this is an important moment. It's a fork in the road of scholarship. And historical work on the Bible and hermeneutic philosophical work on the Bible diverge from each other at this point, and they've never, ever been reconciled.
Yeah, and, you know, as the title of our show indicates, my own training in biblical studies is decidedly that Christian humanist tradition. So when I read Kant's approach to it, I kind of had the same response. I said, who is this guy? And of course, the answer is he's Immanuel Kant. I'm not, but, you know, it didn't
he's got a big advantage in being that. Yeah. But look, I mean, I'm so pleased to be on a program that's got humanism in the title, because my own approach, I self-define as a humanist. Historiographical approach.
Yeah, this book is humanist from start to finish. Absolutely.
And so, I mean, to be on a program that has that in its title is incredibly rare, because, of course, most programs that one goes on are philosophical programs. They're not interested in humanism at all. But humanism is having a big resurgence in scholarship worldwide, I think. That's interesting.
Well, I want to turn to the second half of the book, since we're down to about 20 minutes. And the second half of the book deals with receptions of Kant in his own historical moment. And like I said, the first half of the book, I thought it was interesting. The second half of the book really did the work of convincing me. And the one that really started to do that work was your chapter on what you call the, quote, Catholic Enlightenment, end quote. This is a term because I'm not a historian of European religion. I had not really encountered this term. But it seems that, you know, this had some currency in history departments. So in your research, how do you receive and how do you influence, how do you resist the picture of a Catholic Enlightenment that's happening in Kant's moment? And how does it relate to Kant's spiritual communities, spiritual practices?
No, again, interesting point. One that it's a rabbit hole we could go down and never come out of, but we won't.
There are so many in this book.
we'll stick to the main theme. So the main exponent today of the theme of the Catholic Enlightenment is a scholar called Ulrich L. Lehner, who's, I believe, at Notre Dame in America. He shares with...
Although here we call it Notre Dame.
No, okay. God. I'll learn that. I like
on,
that.
Carry on.
He's at Notre Dame, and he shares with a number of other scholars who have developed the theme of what's called the religious enlightenment. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Now, one of the leading scholars of the who's written a book called The Religious Enlightenment, goodness, I'll have to check on this and get back to you, but mm-hmm. what's common? So there are books on the Jewish Enlightenment, on the Catholic Enlightenment, yes. naturally on the Protestant Enlightenment. That's the original. that is the Enlightenment.
Sure.
But the Catholic one brings up something very interesting, because you could say that in comparison with what I'm doing, where I differ from these works on religious enlightenment as a reception of Kant is that they all continue to hold the philosophical view of Kantian philosophy. In other words, mm-hmm. they continue to think that Kantian philosophy is actually what it says it is. It's grounded in transcendental reflection, and it recovers universal a priori reason. Therefore,
right.
it is not based in doctrine, in teaching.
Mm-hmm.
It is not based in positive religious dogma of any kind. Therefore, mm-hmm. there is a major clash. So how on earth is this clash to be resolved, or how on earth was it resolved? The answer is that they typically say, well, it's resolved because Kant himself created room for faith. And he created room for faith in two ways. Firstly, by having a moral proof of God's existence. Although we can mm-hmm. no longer use the ontological, cosmological arguments, etc., we could show that God was necessary in order to make the moral law effectual. And that's
right.
a proof of God. So that's a way of going, of reconciling ecclesiastical religion and Kantian philosophy. The second way is that he taught that morality is not just rational self-governance, but it is reverence for the moral law. And he says we revere the moral law as if, that's the crucial phrase, as if it were a command of God. It's not.
Right.
But we revere it as if it were. Now,
mm-hmm.
someone like Ulrich Lehner says this gets us to Vatican II. Right? Because what we can say is that this is the way in which we can incorporate a true modern philosophy into Catholic teaching if we accept mm-hmm. Kant's moral proof of God and the moral law as a command of God. We don't have such a gap that we need to overcome. Now, that's one answer to your question, but the crucial one is not touched on by this, which is to say that, well, what did Catholics at the time say,
right?
The last thing they said was, oh, Kant's not a bad guy and we can work out how to reconcile with him. No, they said Kant is not a good guy, and he's not a good guy because of virtue ethics, because Thomism tells us that there's no way you can be saved merely by a way of thinking as a philosopher.
Right.
Right. You cannot be saved outside the church.
Yeah. Jesus has to be involved.
And Jesus has to be involved. I'm going to come back to Jesus. I'm sorry, that's mm-hmm. not the way it sounds, but I am going to come back to the topic of Jesus. There was enormous resistance to Kant in Lutheranism, Catholicism, mm-hmm. and Judaism. But we don't learn that from these modern studies of the religious enlightenments. They're all about how was Kant reconciled mm-hmm. with the ecclesiastical religions. But the ecclesiastical theologians said, we don't want to reconcile. We just mm-hmm. don't want this stuff as part of what we do. And that has to be, we have to really, when we do historical work, we have to take these guys into account. And there's a guy I write about called Benedict Stadler, a major mm-hmm. Jesuit theologian. There's an extraordinary figure in the Lutheran tradition called Gottfried Storr. He was mm-hmm. the leading biblical theologian in Lutheranism. I mean, a huge figure. And if you read modern Hegelian-style philosophical histories, these guys aren't even in the index.
Right.
Right? And you have to say, as a historian, you have to say, listen, if you claim to be doing the history of Kantian philosophy, you cannot ignore major intellectuals just because they were theologians. That doesn't wash, right? I'm getting a bit excited.
As a kind of a follow-up, would the response to Kantian philosophical disciplines in the 18th, early 19th centuries be something akin to the response to the recovery of Aristotle in the high medieval period? Because it seems like this kind of response where in the moment, the response is very much, you know, close the gate, make sure the barbarians don't get in. But then centuries later, it's, oh, yes, we've always been Aristotelians. And you know, I think of the Jesuit historian of philosophy, Frederick Copleston, who is thoroughly Kantian. And, you know, he writes about Thomas Aquinas as if Thomas were a Kantian. So, is that the kind of dynamic we're looking at here?
That absolutely is the dynamic. And you're sketching out a whole other research program here, but you're absolutely right. And there is a
another 500
scholar,
pages.
Another five, not for me, but for someone. But there's a modern scholar who is very good on exactly this theme. And his name is Christopher Insull, Insole. Mm-hmm. He actually has a single essay that's called something like Kant from a Thomist Perspective. That's almost the title. And what he does is he goes through and he says, well, where do Kantianism and Thomism differ in terms of moral philosophy? And he itemizes very clearly where they differ. And he then says, well, what would Kant look like if you read him from a Thomist perspective? And he gives you an account of that. But he doesn't say we should read him from a Thomist perspective. He just says this is what it would look like. But what he's pointing to is that how Kant is received is always factionally determined. And here's a great example is from the Catholic reception. Not just but the Catholic reception, but so the first Jesuit reception by Stadler is amazingly hostile. So Stadler wrote a 2-volume book with a wonderful title, Anti-Kant, right? Anti-Kant. And it's 2 massive volumes, and it is extremely good. I mean, anyone who thinks Stadler is a dogmatic idiot needs to go away and have a proper look. This guy was super, super smart. But he was a Thomist, right? So he says, no, we don't want any of this at all. But the Benedictines, who were anti-Jesuits, said we can work with Kant. So already, this is in the 1790-1810 period, already inside Catholicism, you had 2 radically opposed receptions of Kant. What the Benedictines said is that we can use Kant's ascesis in the training of monks, because what does it give us? Well, it gives us a built-in, a ready-made spiritual exercise through which we challenge young monks to get rid of all of their desires for external happiness, etc., and focus on their own will. And that is crucial in order to become a, you know, Catholic monk of the Benedictine kind. Later on, when you had neo-scholasticism in the middle of the 19th century, you had a radically anti-Kantian movement inside the Catholic Church, and all Kantian philosophy and Kantian philosophers were denounced, in fact, as via anathema. Anathema was pronounced on these people. And then with Vatican II, by the time you get to Vatican II, you've had a completely other revolution. This liberal Catholic Enlightenment thing is now in force. And we still live in the shadow of Vatican II. So in each case, what we can learn from this is that, if you like, the evidence I tried to present to you, and I'm so pleased you were persuaded by it, that one of the best forms of evidence that Kant was engaged in a modern form of spirituality is that he was seen as such by the people that hated him and that loved him. And he's still seen in that way today. So that's important,
I want to turn to the Jewish reception of Kant here at the end, because without the protection of the Prussian laws protecting Christian sects from proselytizing, Jewish communities were uniquely defenseless when the Kantians came for the souls of their young men. Now, you explore several Jewish responses. I encourage our readers to go out, get your book, read all of them. For this show, I want you to comment just briefly on Saul Asher, because for Asher, Kant's communities of philosophical spirituality are not a resource for the synagogue, but they are a dangerous rival to Jewish communities. What is it about Kant that Asher found so menacing?
Yeah. Asher, he's a young man when he's writing. He's an autodidact, as most of them were, because they didn't go to universities and there were no Jewish universities. So Asher had a day job. I think he was a bookseller or something like that. I'd have to check on that. But he published several sort of essays. Now, what Asher responded to in Kant was Kant's teaching that religion could never be founded in positive doctrines or laws. Mm-hmm. Now, given that Judaism is grounded in, firstly, the Torah, in the reading of scripture, in a huge tradition of commentary on literature, of commentary on the Bible, and on laws, on the ceremonial laws of the synagogue, then, of course, if somebody comes along and says, none of that matters because everything depends on your relation to yourself and on your relation to your own moral will, and all of this, all of these laws, all of these observances, all of the commentary on the Torah is just so much superstitious nonsense. It doesn't, you'll never be saved through laws or through adherence to God's commands. Because the only command that matters is the command of reason, of pure practical reason. Now, what Asher picked up on quickly was not just the threat to, if you like, Jewish theology, but to the Jewish community, because Kant's followers said, you Jewish people are currently looking for political and civil rights, but you will not. You'll never have them if you continue to think like this, because civil and political rights depend on reason. They are rights that come from rational freedom. You people don't have that, so why should you be given them? It was a very cruel thing to say, but it was said. And Kant says, not so that in so many words, but in his Conflict of the Faculties book, he says, you will be ready for civil rights when you convert to a form of Christianity as a step towards the moral religion. Now, Asher said this is a threat, and it's a threat we should not put up with, and it's a threat that the Prussian religious constitution, as a offshoot of the German religious constitution, the imperial religious constitution, says that we shouldn't put up with, because it's a pluralist constitution. The whole idea of this is that there are several religions, all of which are allowed to teach their own doctrine as absolute truth. And therefore, so should we. He then foresaw that it might be the case. He lived long enough to see his own books burned in effigy at a student. They were called Burschenschaften. There were student associations, and they had an annual meeting. And at this annual meeting at the Warburg Mountain, they burnt what they called non-German books. And Asher's books were among the books burnt in effigy at this. He had detected that there was a sort of only a small step from saying somebody was not rational to saying they could no longer be part of the German community. Right. So that's a bit blood-curdling, and I conclude the book by reminding people that this these things have consequences. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, there is so much of this book that you all need to go out, read it, enjoy it, benefit from it. But even in the face of everything that we didn't get to, I'm going to ask a self-indulgent question here at the end. How quickly did Kant's influence expand to North America? I ask because in the United States, by the late 1830s, there was a literary circle in New England calling itself the Transcendentalists, and Ralph Waldo Emerson's Divinity School Address of 1838 at Harvard University resonates deeply with the religious philosophical reception of Christian vocabularies, but in that philosophical cast that you set forth as having its roots in those Lutheran seminaries influenced by Kant's spiritual practices. So what common thread should I see here when I look at New England in the 1830s? And to what extent should I explore different directions because I'm looking in the wrong places?
Great. Yeah. I'm not an expert in this, but what I would refer your listeners to are Bruce Kuklick's studies, K-U-K-L-I-C-K, who's written a number of books on the reception of Kantian and Hegelian philosophy in America in the mid-century. And he's written about Jonathan Edwards, for example, and he's written about the St. Louis Hegelians. And he's in writing about this, it's quite straightforward. Americans go to Germany. Philosophers go to Germany and they study with Kantians, they study with Hegelians, and they come back to America and they teach. That's one line of transmission. There's a more subterranean line, which I'm now being a bit more speculative about, in which I would say something like that a key enabler of this reception is what we could call Unitarianism, Protestant American Unitarianism. Kant is in a way a Unitarian, right? Because he says God only has one nature and that Christ is just a human being. I'm still getting back to Christ. So the Transcendentalists were Unitarians. And what they found in Kant was something that merged quite directly with this notion that firstly, God was a transcendental figure, and he was of one nature. And secondly, Christ was an eminent and magnificent moral teacher, but he was a man. And we could learn through contemplation of God and through contemplation of nature, we could have access to a transcendental dimension of reality. I'm not an expert, but this was part of what was going on. Now, interestingly, by the end of the 19th century, there were figures in the high bureaucracy of the American education system who were Kantians and Hegelians. And they thought that education in general should have this formative spiritual character. And that was part of what was going on in the design of various kinds of university and curricula. But if we keep in mind that Harvard, Yale, and Princeton were originally seminaries, Protestant seminaries, which is what Kuklick focuses on, we can get a sense of how this transmission comes through into the modern period. Now, to leap one step farther forward, that one would then alight immediately on John Rawls. John Rawls is the inheritor of all of this. He creates a theory of justice which is completely Kantian, and which relies, for example, on a notion of the kingdom of ends, of intelligences who occupy an original position behind a veil of ignorance and choose the best possible moral constitution for a political body and so forth. And then you've got Rawls' students, people like Christine Korsgaard, I think Alan Wood, Paul Geyer, I'm not sure exactly who, but the transmission line is pretty direct. These are then the major philosophers, if you like, that I depart from to go back to the very beginning of our conversation. Who say that, well, Kant is basically a guy who recovered the fundamental principles of knowledge and morality by reflecting on his own mind. That's what they teach. And that is a direct transmission of, if you like, Kantianism into the American university scene. Yeah.
Very good. Well, Ian, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about Kant, German seminaries, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Okay. I'm in two minds. I mean, part of me wants to say, well, part of me wants to go back to the humanism thing. I think we might have done that. I mean, there are two senses of humanism. The one that you and I have talked about, which is the idea that there are human letters, the humanities. One approaches these things as achievements in history and in time and so forth. The other sense of humanism is the more religious and ideological one, that the human being is the ultimate pinnacle of creation, that man is an end in himself, that this brings its own value and so forth. That's the Kantian side as well. These are very different models of humanism, but you and your listeners will be familiar with them. I fall on the first side, and the first side doesn't necessarily have anything to say about the human being as an end in itself, as the ultimate moral end of creation. It just says, well, humanism is the recovery of learning from human letters. So in this sense, for example, Machiavelli is a humanist, a major humanist, and he has nothing to say about human beings as the, you know, as a moral end in themselves, right? Kant is a humanist in the other sense, and he has nothing to say about the history of religion. So they're very, very different things. That's one way of ending up. Maybe that's enough, but I feel like I wanted to say something about the figure of Christ, because Christ is everywhere in Kant, but he's never there as the Christ that's taught in the ecclesiastical religions. He's a symbol. And at one point in the Critique of Practical Reason, Kant says the archetype of a moral person existed in humanity for all eternity, prior to the Bible, prior to everything, but it existed there as an archetype, and he calls this archetype the Son of God. Now, at the same time as calling this archetype of the good person as the Son of God, he says that's not Jesus, right? He's used the language, but it's not Jesus. Jesus was an historical man, and he was probably the archetype. He was the best image of this eternal archetype in human reason. Now, you can imagine that when people in the Catholic, Lutheran churches read this for the first time, they said, no, you're completely wrong, because Jesus was incarnate, and as he was both God and man, and more to the point, in the Eucharist, he is that every week, every Sunday. And it's only through that that we can become morally regenerate. The idea that we are all Jesus, which is what this means in Kant, is completely unacceptable. For me, as an historian, standing outside and looking at this, my interest is in saying each of these positions is defensible, it has followers, but they shouldn't be confused with each other. And particularly if you're a philosopher, you shouldn't be able to say those people that continue to believe in regeneration through Christ in the church are somehow lesser beings, not as smart as we people who save ourselves through transcendental reason. No, from my point of view, these are just different ways of becoming transforming yourself. An historian can only say that's the way things are. They can't say any more than that. Is that an okay way to finish?
I think that's a great way to finish. Ian Hunter, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
And thank you very much for having me, Nathan. I've had a ball, I have to say.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is The Kantian Religion from Princeton University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.